Welcome to Medically Speaking, Auburn's own medical radio show with host Dr. Mark Vaughn of the Auburn Medical Group and Larry Finney.
Welcome to another show of Medically Speaking Radio with myself, Dr. Mark Vaughn of the Auburn Medical Group.
And I'm Larry Finney, the one who's not a doctor.
That's what it says in the promos. Well, it's been an interesting week. We have quite a few things to go over, things to look forward to. We still want to let everybody know about how they can communicate with us through our fan page on Facebook. We're really happy about that and glad to see a lot of people there and happy for participation when it comes. So feel free to use that and become a fan of it.
Yeah, if you're searching around on Facebook, it's simply Medically Speaking Radio.
Just like our website, medicallyspeakingradio.com. We're going to go ahead and talk about what's coming up in this show. We have Dr. Gurvinder Shaheed, who is a medical oncologist right here in Auburn, works out of Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. We're very glad to have him. We're going to be speaking about cancer prevention in this show, and we look forward to what he has to share with us. We also have our usual disclaimer that we need to get out of the way here. And who's going to do it this week?
It's a much anticipated portion of our show. I think you did it last week rather rapidly. I'll do it, but with a pace of purpose here. Here we go. The disclaimer. The content of this website and the Medically Speaking Radio Show are meant for entertainment and for general information purposes. No doctor-patient relationship is attempted or implied through the show or the website. Any medical advice, home remedies, and all other medical information on this website or radio show should not be treated as a substitute for the medical advice of your own doctor. Do not attempt any treatment mentioned on the website or the show without consulting your doctor. Always consult your own doctor if you are in any way concerned about your health. If you need a doctor and live in near Placer County, call Jen at 530-886-8630. If you have a medical emergency, call 911. Medically Speaking Radio, Dr. Mark Vaughn, Auburn Medical Group, K-High Radio, and our sponsors are not responsible for any diagnosis or treatment made by anyone based on any of the content of this website or the Medically Speaking Radio show. In addition, the views and opinions expressed on the show or on linked websites are not necessarily those of Dr. Mark Vaughn, K-High Radio, the Auburn Medical Group, or any of the show sponsors. Actual mileage may vary. Small parts may provide a choking hazard, etc.
Okay. Thank you for doing that.
Yes. So, having disclaimed everything, we're gonna march forward now and tell you that eating chocolate is just good for you.
Yeah, tell us about that. There was a study that recently came out in the Journal of Internal Medicine? Yeah, Journal of Internal Medicine, their September issue. It's not September yet, but their September issue is out saying this. So,
well, the headline says, heart attack survivors benefit from chocolate consumption. Heart attack victims may want to gravitate toward the chocolate choices on the menu, thinking of it not just as a treat, but as a potential lifesaver. Now, they don't make chocolate lifesavers. You know, they make them a mint, wintergreen, cherry, whatever. But no, not that kind of lifesaver. No, regular chocolate. While past reports have indicated some potential benefits to eating chocolate, we now have new evidence showing a previous heart attack patient may be avoiding death by consuming two or more servings of chocolate per week.
Now, let's tell the listeners what this is based on. This study was done in Sweden, I believe.
Let's see.
Stockholm County, if I remember.
Oh, yes, Institute. Yeah, the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
Okay. So they took 1,169 non-diabetic men and women, 45 to 70 years old.
Right.
And if I remember correct, I'm trying to remember if it was the people who had already had the heart attack, and then they surveyed them as they got discharged.
You're right.
Okay.
Yeah, something like 1,200 non-diabetic men and women ranging in age from 45 to 70 located in Stockholm County.
Yeah, and so what they found is that the death rate of, no, that's not how it happened, because if that's what it was, then how could they interview the people who died?
Death by chocolate.
Anyway, it's based on asking people after they got out of the hospital, having survived the heart attack, how much chocolate they have. And the article just does this is not the real article. This is somebody else reporting the news on it. It doesn't make sense because they're telling you that it's a survey after people got out of the hospital about how much chocolate they ate and that the people who had more chocolate were the people who survived. But it doesn't say how they got the information on the people who didn't survive. So we'd have to actually get a hold of this this article in the Journal of Internal Medicine, which you would think a title like Journal of Internal Medicine is a regular medical journal. And it probably is, but it is not one that I can easily get my hands on. It is not one of the big ones.
Well, and I'm a little cynical because isn't Sweden a chocolate producing country? Or am I thinking of Switzerland? But here's what it says. The
Germany,
study began
Mexico.
Yeah. The study began in the early 90s with patient data being gathered, beginning when they were first hospitalized for their first heart attack. Study participants were then asked several questions in regard to their diets from the previous year prior to their first heart attack, including questions regarding chocolate consumption and frequency. 3 months following discharge from the hospital, study participants were given health examinations, and they were continually monitored over the next 8 years.
Okay.
Now, the research says our findings support increasing evidence that chocolate is a rich source of beneficial bioactive compounds. And they found that the more chocolate a previous heart attack sufferer consumed during a week, the lower their risks of dying from a heart attack. And that's all the evidence I need.
So it actually was an 8-year prospective trial.
If that's what you want to call it. I call it an excuse to eat all the chocolate I want.
It actually does look good for chocolate.
But I don't want to do the heart attack part first or anything like that.
You know, you were expecting me to totally poo-poo this thing.
I did. I think, you know, you were going to suck all the fun out of this one, just like the drinking and cussing one. You're going to suck all the fun out of that and say, no.
I'm not.
Bring us all down to earth.
Surprise, I'm not.
Now, the doctor who did the study does add that, you know, if you've got weight problems or, you know, diabetic issues, obviously this isn't going to work for you. But he says, for individuals with no weight issues who have been able to eat chocolate in moderation and remain slim, I do not limit it. But then again, the person who eats just pounds of chocolate and remains slim, does that person exist? So, of course, you're not going to limit it.
He's talking about an N of zero.
Yes.
Okay. And then in the time we have left before the break, I want to hear what you had about the governor. What was he doing in regards to the health board?
Yeah, I guess there was a flap recently about the fact that it took an average of 3 years to conclude investigations of nurses accused of wrongdoing so that
we talked about that.
Yeah, the Board of Nursing got in some trouble. So the paper's quoting Schwarzenegger saying that the health worker discipline delays are absolutely unacceptable. And he's going to take care of that. Governor Schwarzenegger conceded that longstanding delays in disciplining errant health professionals were absolutely unacceptable and promised broad reforms to better protect patients from dentists, pharmacists, therapists, and others accused of misconduct. And basically, he intends to do this by beefing up all 18 of the so-called healing arts boards.
18 healing arts boards. Say?
Okay, there's the medical board.
That's the one I'm under.
Osteopath board. Mm-hmm. Dentistry.
Okay.
Nursing. These are just off the top of my head. Acupuncture. Behavioral sciences. I'm thinking of psychiatry as a separate one. I don't know. Anyway,
well,
there are 18 of them.
Yeah, there's behavioral health. Psychiatry would actually be the medical board.
Right. Optometry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any others?
Massage therapists.
Okay. Now, didn't Craigslist shut them down or...
Not those massage therapists.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. Enough about, and the horse whisperer, right?
The horse whisperer's board. Yeah.
It does look like we're coming up on our break. So when we come back, we'll have Dr. Shahid speaking with us about cancer, screening.
But if you're a doctor, you could expect a greater flurry of investigators and auditors to follow you around. So that's probably
or
just
a nurse,
great
or
news.
A massage therapist or horse whisperer.
Absolutely. All right.
We'll be back after the break.
Gritstone Rock Club is Auburn's premier climbing and fitness facility. They offer rock climbing instruction for climbers of all ages and ability levels. In addition to classes, Gritstone Rock Club hosts birthday parties, has a team-building ropes course, and provides professional outdoor instruction. If you want to climb with Gritstone Rock Club, contact them at 530-885-ROCK or online at gritstonerockclub.com.
Larry, have you ever been to Auburn Drug Company?
Yeah, that's the one with the marble soda fountain at 815 Lincoln Way.
Yeah, right there in front they have the marble fountain, and in back is an independently owned pharmacy right here in Auburn.
And that thing has been around for a long time.
Since the 1800s. They are so great because they actually fill your prescriptions when you ask them to, unlike the chain drug stores that make you wait.
You know, and waiting there wouldn't be a big crime because, heck, you could always go to the soda fountain. That's Auburn Drug Company at 815 Lincoln Way in downtown Auburn. Give them a call at 885-6524.
Few things in life are harder than thinking about serious illness or the death of someone you love. Research confirms that Americans want the basic services that hospice provides, care at home or in a home-like setting, treatment that preserves a sense of dignity and respect. Emotional and spiritual support for patients and for their families, and effective pain management. Hospice helps patients and their families deal with end-of-life challenges in a life-affirming, compassionate way that brings dignity, hope, and love to every day of life. This message of love and caring is the focus of hospice care. This message is brought to you by Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice. We can be reached at 886-6650 or click on the link for Sutter Auburn Faith Hospice on the Medically Speaking Radio website.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back from the break. Now we have, as promised, Dr. Shahid from Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital. He is one of our oncologists here. And what we'd like to do is talk a little bit about, starting out with, cancer prevention. And not so much prevention as screening. There's a number of tests out there that are talked about. Some are useful, some are not useful, some are actually a little bit dangerous to use for the wrong purpose of screening for cancer. What can you tell us, Dr. Shahid, about screening tests that are useful for cancer screening?
Well, let me go back to your previous comment, cancer screening, and you use the term prevention as well. Well, some of the screening tests do prevent cancer as well, and among them is actually colonoscopies. Let's talk about colon cancer prevention. There are different tests you can do to find cancer early. Being a medical oncologist, most of the times I see patients with advanced cancer. And in that stage, we cannot cure cancer. The key to winning this battle against cancer is finding it early and curing it. And these screening tests do help. In colon cancer, the common question I get asked is colonoscopy better than flexible sigmoidoscopy?
And what are these two things, a colonoscope and a sigmoidoscope? What's the difference between them?
Well, what we are trying to do is we're trying to find a cancer in the colon. So a flexible both of these are small tubes which we introduced in the colon and has a camera at the tip through which we can take images and we can see. Colonoscopy is a longer scope. So basically it's the difference is the size of the scope. The flexible sigmoidoscope is a smaller scope. It's about 60 centimeters. Now, we can always say, well, the longer the scope, better, because we can see the whole of the colon. So what's the difference? Well, 50% of the colon cancers are within that 60-centimeter flexible sigmoidoscope.
You said 50%?
Yes, so 50%.
So half of them you can get with the shorter scope.
Half of them you can get with the shorter scope. But if you find a polyp or any other abnormality, the recommendations are to go for colonoscopy or a certain other test, which is like a barium enema, in which we introduced barium and take pictures. We can catch 30% more. So sensitivity with the sigmoidoscope, we can say, is we can catch 80% of the cancers.
80% with the sigmoidoscope?
Sigmoidoscope. And if we find a polyp, go for colonoscopy. Then we can catch 80% of the cancers right there and then.
80%. Sigmoidoscope followed up by colonoscopy.
If there's a polyp, if it's an abnormal.
Okay.
Now, colonoscopy by itself has to travel all through the colon, so there's a risk of perforation. There is availability is a big issue. It has to be done by trained specialists, and not many are available.
So are you saying there is no risk of perforation with a sigmoidoscope?
Smaller scope, thinner scope, less chances of perforation. Colon is a very twisted structure. So if you longer you have to go, more turns you have to take, and more chances of perforations are there. So there are lesser risk with flexible sigmoidoscope than with the colonoscope, which is a longer scope. Now, colonoscopy adds about 10% to the sensitivity. So we can catch about 90%. And it also depends upon the person doing it. Also depends upon how the prep was. We need to clean the colon. So if the colon wasn't cleaned properly beforehand, you can still miss. So we still cannot be 100% sure that the cancer is not there. 90% sensitivity. So 90% of the cancers we can find with colonoscopy. So the current American Cancer Society recommendations at this time are every 5 years, you go with a flexible sigmoidoscope and the stool test, or a colonoscopy every 10 years. And that's for somebody who does not have a risk for colon cancer.
Risk factor being family history.
Family history, prior history of polyps is another, or some genetic predisposition to have cancer. In those situations, you need colonoscopy. Number one is more frequently, which is about 1 to 3 years, depending upon the condition, depending upon the risk factors, and then every 5 years. Also, you may have to start the screening sooner. General guidelines are 5 to 10 years earlier than your youngest diagnosed family member with colon cancer.
5 years younger?
No. Let me give you an example. Let's say somebody's brother was diagnosed with colon cancer at age 50. So that person needs to start screening with colonoscopy at least at age 45, if not 40. So 10 years earlier than the youngest family member diagnosed with colon cancer.
Okay, 10 years. All right. And if there is no risk, then we start at 50 years?
Then we start at age 50.
Okay. I wanted to do a follow-up question. I'm sorry, I should have done it earlier. You were talking about the risk of perforation. That's actually blowing a hole in the in the colon. Being higher with colonoscopy than sigmoidoscopy, even though you can get maybe 10% better results looking for cancer with the more extensive colonoscopy. How significant is that difference? Because we're talking 10% gain on one end.
Mm-hmm.
How much more dangerous is the colonoscopy as far as perforation? Do you have percentages offhand or?
Well, number one is when I use the term a perforation, I did not mean that it was the risk was 20%, 30%. Any screening test which we use first has to be safe. So when I'm talking about the risk of perforation, I'm not talking about 10%. I'm not talking about 15%. So it's less than 5% or so. Now, again, depends upon a person's colon as well. I mean, how tortuous the colon is, how difficult the procedure is. And when you're talking about those low numbers, then the percentages difference between, let's say, sigmoidoscopy and flexible, if there is 5%, then another one is 3%. So the percentages, if I calculate, would be like 30, 40%. But in real terms, it's not great. But even if you can avoid three perforations, it's still worth it. And also the cost involved and the availability involved as well.
At the risk of missing that some in that 10% who would actually have colon cancer and we didn't catch it. So you have to take into account how prevalent colon cancer is.
Right. Now, you have to look at another thing is you have to look at is it's do we save life by finding each cancer? Okay. So the only way we can save lives is if we find cancer early. I'll give you an example of lung cancer. Now, lung cancer is the biggest killer. The problem with lung cancer is we do not have any good screening test. At this time, there are no recommendations for regular screening for lung cancer in a person who does not have weight loss or any symptoms which are suggestive of cancer. Now, giving an example, Early Lung Cancer Action Project, that's an international study group, they screened 30,000 people. They did CAT scan and x-rays on everybody. They found about 250 lung nodules. So out of 30,000, 250 people had abnormal test. Now, they got biopsied. So 250 people ended up having biopsy. Out of those, only 27 were found to have cancer.
27 out of 250
who underwent a biopsy.
Okay. So there was reason to rule out cancer, but yet we only found that a fifth of them roughly actually had it.
Of the ones biopsied, not of the ones screened. Screened were 30,000. Now, out of those, only 23 had stage one, where we could have made a difference. Now, with the follow-up, we have not demonstrated that if these people started with coughing and then had the scanning done versus had the routine scanning like this, which group lived longer. So we have not shown in that situation that there is a benefit of making people live longer with this. And 225 people got unnecessary procedures done where they could have had complications, including lung collapse.
Not only those people who got the procedures, but even the people who were screened, they were exposed to radiation that is potentially cancer-causing?
Yes. Now with the greater availability of these radiations, I shouldn't use the term radiation, but the scans, which give radiation, another thing we have to think about is during lifetime, are we increasing the risk of cancer with these radiations down the road? Right now, we do not have good studies to really show that. And we used to do x-rays and we used to say, okay, radiation risk is smaller. But with these newer scans, with the CAT scans, these nuclear medicine scans, the radiation risk is increasing. So we have to start thinking about and maybe start doing clinical trials to look at this risk by itself as well.
Okay. And then if a person is found to have cancer here in the Auburn area, we actually have services that treat most types of cancers right here in town, and we need to let people know about that. Can you tell us a little bit about what's available through our local hospital and associated facilities?
Yes. Cancer needs a very specialized treatment, and people do not have to really travel long distance for this. Now, when somebody gets diagnosed with cancer, it's not that that person is affected. It's the whole family is affected, and it's not just physical, emotional, but also social issue as well. So closer we can provide care to home, better outcomes we can get, not just on the physical front, but also emotional front as well. Now, we are I being a medical oncologist here, and I work closely with Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, and Auburn Faith has been at the forefront of providing us these services. We have medical oncologists here. We have good surgeons here. We have radiation oncology here. We have good pathologists here. So not only in diagnostics, but also treatment-wise. Commission on Cancer, which is a program of American College of Surgeons, gave us a full 3-year accreditation approval with commendation for the cancer program at Auburn Faith. And this is the highest distinction possible.
That's the American College of Surgeons.
Yes.
They're saying Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital is the place to have your cancer treated.
Yes. They what they do is they come in, they do the surveys, they review the records, they look at the services, and they only certify if we meet their standards. And their standards are basically that we meet the national standards to be able to provide quality state-of-the-art services at that facility.
Okay. We have to take a break right now, but when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about services available here for
for cancer. And if we can, come back a little bit more to cancer screening. This is Medically Speaking Radio on KHI AM 950. And as soon as we're done with these messages, we'll come back.
Since 1966, Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital has been providing award-winning care to members of the community, to people just like you. The tradition of excellence continues today with our comprehensive family birth center, cancer services, 24-hour emergency care, and a whole range of outpatient services with convenient hours and locations to serve you.
In addition, we've been recognized for excellence in managing heart attacks, heart failure, pneumonia, and surgical care. We are one of a select few hospitals in the state to earn recognition from VHA's West Coast region for sustained outstanding clinical performance.
To learn more about Sutter Auburn Faith Hospital, visit us on the web at sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio. That's sutterauburnfaith.org/medicallyspeakingradio.
Sutter Health, with you for life.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I want to tell you about my dentist, Rodney Kihara. His office is located right in town at High Street and Auburn Folsom Road. His staff is pleasant. They smile when you walk in, and you know who they are because they're there every time. We're talking about Flo, Cheryl, and Judy. Their pleasant faces welcome you into the office and let you know that you're in the right spot, a comfortable place to go to the dentist. Call Dr. Kihara's office at 888-1966. That's 888-1966.
The doctor would say, don't stick anything in your ear. Unless, of course, it's Medically Speaking. On KHI, the voice of the foothills. Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
Welcome back to Medically Speaking Radio. We are here with Dr. Gurvinder Shahid, who is an oncologist right here in Auburn. Larry, can you give us a more proper introduction than that?
Yeah, like I said, I think maybe a trumpet fanfare would be good, but Dr. Shahid went to medical school in India, and he did his residency at Abington Memorial Hospital in Philadelphia, where he was the chief resident. He practiced for 4 years in the Bay Area and has his fellowship in hematology and oncology at Georgetown University. He's been practicing here in Auburn since 2006.
Okay. Dr. Shahid, thank you for your patience and letting us do our introduction there. We had talked about colon cancer screening, and I wanted to just summarize that again because you had spoken about both colonoscopy and sigmoidoscopy. And I noticed, Larry, that you didn't tell our listeners what that is in terms that it's unmistakable where these tubes are going and what they're doing.
Well, I don't want to be too graphic. I've been through the whole thing. I mean the whole thing, the full Monty. I went through the entire colonoscopy. I think for those patients who are considering one or the other, or trying to make up their minds from a, shall we say, aesthetic standpoint, that the patient prep process is identical in both cases. And I decided, hey, if I have to go through all of that purging, I'm going to go the distance. And frankly, I was unconscious. I remember nothing. So, you know, it was not unpleasant.
And I wanted to throw in my 2 cents worth on sigmoidoscopy versus colonoscopy. I think, Dr. Shahid, you seem to lean more towards sigmoidoscopy rather than colonoscopy for general screening. Is that correct?
That's correct to an extent that that's current guidelines as well. But also you have to look at is at this time, if you looking for a screening colonoscopy, there's a wait of about 4 to 6 months. Flexible sigmoidoscopy, we have more trained people and you can get it sooner. So most of the times I have seen people just delayed. And once you delay it, you may not never be able to get to it. Of course, there is a 10% more benefit with the colonoscopy than the flexible sigmoidoscopy. So then there's another modality which is in the news these days is virtual colonoscopy. So what is that? That actually is basically a scan for a colon. Now, that's better. So you don't have to go through an invasive procedure and still be able to look at the colonoscopy. So what are the issues? The issues are the prep is still the same. So you still have to clean your colon. Second issue is that it's still in an early stages. So we still have not demonstrated that it is better than the regular optical colonoscopy. There were two trials which showed that it was equal. Then there was another clinical trial which showed that it may not be as good. So at this time, I would say jury is still out on that procedure. So colonoscopy is better than that. So now if I can, again, I would say if you are at a higher risk, if you have a family history of colon cancer, or if you had blood in your stools, or if you had a polyp in the past, then you do need colonoscopy. But if you are at an average risk, then the studies have shown that flexible sigmoidoscopy along with a stool examination is acceptable.
Annual. Every year, stool examination.
Every year, stool examination.
For blood.
For blood. And every 5 years of flexible sigmoidoscopy. Now, you have to look at it. When they recommend colonoscopy, they say every 10 years. So they do increase the frequency of flexible sigmoidoscopy to try to come up with an equal detection rate.
Now, you had mentioned virtual colonoscopy, that being like a CAT scan.
Yes.
We are learning more and more about the risks of radiation of CAT scans. And oftentimes a CAT scan of the abdomen is not just one scan, but two, sometimes even three separate scans across the body. And each scan is, I'm trying to remember the correct number, and you may know it from some of your literature, I'm thinking 1,000 times the radiation dose to the organs of a chest x-ray?
I would say not exact. Well, I would say probably to that extent, yes.
So 1,000 times. And we know that it's worse depending on your age. For example, infants, much more damage from the radiation than in adults. Also, it has to do with your, well, that's body size there, but also age. Age and body size both make that difference. And in some recent reports that I've been reading, they estimate that the increased risk in cancer over a lifetime is equal in an infant getting an abdominal series of scans, CAT scan, to a survivor from the atomic blast in Hiroshima.
That is actually true. Not just the infants, because infants are much more sensitive to it, but we can look around and say how many scans we do on people, and even adults may be exposed to that much radiation as well. So that's another reason why the CAT scans for the lungs, these virtual colonoscopies, have not really got a hold. Because we have to show, as I said, that by doing a test, we are making people live longer. But if we are giving them cancer, that's not the right. So right now, as of now, there is no CAT scan which is recommended as a screening for any test.
Okay. And that's
any cancer, sorry.
That's a bit of a soapbox that I get on all the time, is unnecessary tests. And so I thank you for bringing that out on our show, that it really is dangerous to be getting these CAT scans looking for something that may not be there, instead of using them in the proper clinical setting. And that is, this person is sick. This person we know has a problem. The scan is going to help us come up with a treatment for them.
And that takes your point to what I talked about earlier about that study about lung cancer, that 250 abnormal scans and 225 people got unnecessary biopsies. So not just the radiation and having cancers down the road, but also having unnecessary biopsies and having complications from that. So the best way to do something is to look at, to increase the sensitivity of that. And what by that I mean is, you have to say, is this person, what's the risk of this person having cancer? And if the risk is high enough, and if you do a scan, you're more likely to find the cancer. So if you are having some symptoms, you're losing weight or you're coughing up blood, yes, if I do the scan, we will be finding. That's not a screening. So that's diagnostic. So in screening, if somebody's healthy, no clear-cut risk factors, we do a scan, it's a hit and miss. And also, you can, if you keep doing it, you give the down the road, you run the risk of giving that person a cancer.
And you were talking before about the people who actually got these nodules that were discovered, biopsied. they actually had to have a surgical procedure. There's complications. A certain number of them actually got injured and were hurt by this. Enough so that the people who had a cancer discovered in the screening, that doesn't offset how many got hurt in the end. That's what you were saying, that it's just not worth it.
It's not worth it. What you have to look at is, we always throw statistics around. For a person, it's 0% or 100%. So, right. So if I'm the person who got the scan done and had a biopsy, and then my lung collapsed, for me, it's a dangerous procedure. So even if one person gets a complication, we have to seriously think about the procedure. And how many lives do we save, and what are the risks involved, we have to look at closely before we come up with the recommendations.
Okay. And we were going to talk about other types of screening. We talked about colon cancer in great detail. In fact, I think that took up half of the segment. What are some of the other effective ones? Because there aren't that many that there's really good general population, meaning everybody, screening. What are the other ones that are actually been found to be worthwhile?
Right. So what are we doing with the screening? We're trying to catch cancer early and prolong person's life. So not every cancer we are able to do that. So at this time, we have effective screenings for breast cancer, colon we just talked about, prostate, cervical cancer, lung we don't have, and also ovarian cancer is a common question I asked, and there are no recommendations for that. So let me go down by the ones which we have, as you asked. So the first one, most common, is breast cancer. So we do have effective screenings for breast cancer. Self-breast examination, clinical breast examination, examination done by a doctor, and mammography. And then there are newer tests, MRIs, ultrasound. So now, what are the recommendations? Who should get screened and when? For a long time, there was a controversy about at what age should we start screening. Some guidelines were 50 years, some 40 years. Now, everybody has a consensus about starting the screening in average risk. I'm not talking about people who have a strong family history or have some other genetic mutations which can put them at a high risk. So in somebody who has average risk, they should get mammograms at age 40. Now, they need to be instructed or shown how to do a proper self-breast examination starting at age 20. And they need a clinical breast exam by a doctor also starting at age 20 every 3 years. Now, why is the difference? Only 15% of the cancer which we diagnose are diagnosed by self-breast examination. There's a lack of technique, lack of proper education, and sometimes people don't do it. Now, the clinical breast examination adds to that sensitivity. Now, if I say, okay, at age 40, I'm going to get a mammogram, so why do I need a breast examination? Well, mammogram's going to pick up 85% of the cancers. 85%, you're still missing about 15% of the cancers. So along with the clinical breast examination, I can tell you I have some patients who had a lump but was not picked up by the mammogram but by breast examination. So you do need both of them once a year after age 40. Then another question I commonly get asked is, there's a digital mammography. So what's the difference between the screening and digital? Screening, the regular ones is we're talking about where they take a film and the radiologist looks at it, at a picture, and then tells you if you have any suspicious spot or not. Now, in digital, it's a digital picture. So the advantage is we can blow that picture up, we can change the angles, look at it. Well, early clinical studies have not shown significant difference between the diagnosis. There is decreased incidence of callback mammograms. What is a callback mammogram? We do a mammogram, a film-based mammogram. There's something suspicious. We need a better image. We need a closer image. So a person has to go and do the mammogram again. If it's a digital picture, we can blow it up. So digital mammography is, I would say, better, upcoming, And eventually, my belief is that's where we are heading as a screening modality as well. It is available now, but we don't have enough machines yet, and we have not really clearly demonstrated superiority looking at all comers. So in somebody with a high risk, I usually do go for digital mammography. Somebody has a thick breast or cancer.
You mentioned digital. Let's go to a digital of a different kind, the every guy's favorite, the digital rectal examination for prostate screening. How effective is that?
That's a different digital.
Exactly. That's what I said. How effective is that, and at what age should that screening begin?
Okay. Now, for prostate cancer, there is a digital rectal examination, which is old school digital. And then there is a PSA. Some people say prostate-specific anxiety as well. Now, these are the two modalities we use. At age 50, we need let's go with the recommendations first, and then we'll dissect them. Recommendations are at age 50, we need to do both digital rectal examination as well as PSA check. Now, prostate cancer is a slowly growing disease. So if somebody has other chronic condition where their life expectancy is less than 10 years, the usual recommendations have been that even if we catch it, it's not going to make any difference. Now, it's not a very sensitive test as a digital rectal examination. What we do is we try to feel the prostate with a finger and see if there's a lump or not.
I was going to say, I beg to differ about its sensitivity. But continue, please.
He was talking about the doctor's side of it.
Well, yeah, all I know is what I know.
Now, if, let's say, a doctor does it, and now with Larry sitting here, I'm hesitating to use the term now feel. So if I feel a nodule there, there's an increased, fivefold increased risk that could be a cancer. So that leads to a biopsy, and if it's a cancer, we catch it, and we catch it early. The same thing with the PSA. PSA is a very sensitive test. Now, you have to know that it is not specific for cancer. That's why I said prostate-specific anxiety. It can be increased in infection. Just doing a digital examination, feeling the prostate with the finger also bumps it up as well. So it could be from just non-cancerous enlargement of the prostate. We call it benign prostatic hypertrophy. So there are many things which can increase the PSA. So nowadays, what we do is we look at PSA velocity. What do I mean by that? We look at a number, let's say somebody's baseline PSA is 3. How does it increase? How fast does it increase? And that makes us more suspicious, and we do the biopsy based on that.
Okay. I'm sorry. We totally ran out of time. We have to have a commercial break. We still have to cover cervical cancer screening, talk about ovarian cancer screening. Any others? We'll get back to them. So we're going to take a commercial break now.
This is Dr. Mark Vaughn. I wanted to let you know a little bit about our practice at the Auburn Medical Group. The physician, nurses, and front desk personnel all approach the patient, asking themselves the question, how would I want to be treated if I was in the patient's shoes? Listen to what one of our patients has to say about her experience at the Auburn Medical Group.
My name is Susie Brown. I just want to sincerely thank that group of people for being there for me in some emergency situations. They are very efficient. Their staff, including their receptionist, even when you call her, she's got sympathy and compassion for you. And when you're ill, that's what you need. The nurse staff is wonderful, and Dr. Vaughn listens to everything you say, and they just get on things. They do not let anything lag.
If you need a doctor, call us at 886-8630 or look at our website at auburnmedicalgroup.com.
Do you find yourself overspending, overeating, or in unhealthy relationships? Is your anger out of control, or do you struggle with drugs and alcohol? Are you tired of just trying harder to deal with your struggles? If you answered yes to any of these questions, there's help available. Celebrate Recovery is an international ministry that meets locally at Parkside Church. 3885 Richardson Drive, Auburn. Meetings are held every Friday night from 6 to 9:15 p.m. All areas of recovery are welcome. Celebrate Recovery is a Christ-centered, 12-step recovery program that offers real and lasting change. Contact Sheila Dobbin at 823-9911. That's 823-9911. For a listing of Celebrate Recovery locations, go to CelebrateRecovery.com. We invite you to join us at Parkside as we celebrate recovery.
Now, back to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney.
And we're back from the break. You're listening to Medically Speaking with Dr. Mark Vaughn and Larry Finney. We're on with Dr. Gurvinder Shahid, an oncologist here with Sutter Medical Group in Auburn. And before the break, Dr. Shahid, we were...
Actually, what's the name of your group?
It's North Cal Hematology Oncology.
North Cal.
My mistake. We were talking about cancer screening, specifically the digital rectal exam and the prostate-specific antigen test, one being a blood test, and you were starting to talk about PSA velocity.
Mm-hmm. So PSA is a simple blood test. So it's just a blood draw, and then we get the results. Now, prostate cells, even the normal prostate cells, also make PSA. So it's not just a cancer cell is making the PSA. Its level makes us worried or not worried about cancer. So if the level is normal or high normal, there's a question about should that how worried we should be to see if this person has a cancer and should we do the biopsy. So for a long time, let's give an example. 4.1 used to be a cutoff for a PSA. That's the number, the lab reports. Now, with 4.1 PSA, you can still miss majority of prostate cancers in people less than age 60. And on the flip side of it, if you use that cutoff and anybody above 4.1, you end up doing biopsy, two-thirds of the people you do biopsy on, you do not find cancer.
So really, it's not a cancer test. It's a screening test for further testing.
Yes. Now, we needed to make it more sensitive. Sensitive in a sense that we need to make it that it should reflect that a person does or does not have a cancer. Now, how do we do that? So what we do is that we get a baseline. Let's say somebody's PSA comes at 4. Now, next year, that PSA has gone up to 6. We repeat it again, 3 months, it's gone up to 8. So that's what I mean by velocity. What is the rate of increase of PSA? That makes me worried. So that will guide me to get a biopsy on that person. But if somebody's PSA is 4, stays at 4, or even if the baseline is 5, stays at 5, next one is 5.5, 4.5, I'm not as worried. So in that situation, I can just wait and watch. So that's what we call PSA velocity. Now, the next cancer which we screen, which we can screen for and save lives and also actually decrease the incidence as well, is cervical cancer. For cervical cancer, the guidelines say that you need to start screening for cervical cancer with a pap smear, which is done in doctor's office, starting at age 18 or when the person gets sexually active. And it needs to be done every 2 to 3 years. Now, American Cancer Society also adds on to this is another test for HPV, human papilloma virus test, which they say you need to start at age 30. And then if both pap smear and this test comes back negative, you can do the testing every 3 years. With cervical cancer, we also have decrease the incidence because we can catch the cancer in a precancerous stage and do the surgeries and prevent the cancer from happening down the road.
Prevent the cancer because we see it before it actually reaches the definition of cancer. We're seeing the changes before they get to the point of being cancer, in quotes.
Yes. Now, we do the same thing with the colon cancer as well. So if we do the colonoscopy or a flexible sigmoidoscopy, we take the polyp out. It may be precancerous. We've prevented a cancer here. So these two modalities, we are not only catching cancer early, but we are also preventing it. Now, another common cancer where we struggle to find a good screening test is ovarian cancer. And commonly we say, well, we do have a blood test, CA-125. It's a tumor marker. In somebody who has ovarian cancer, commonly its level is high. So why can't we use that to screen it? We can also do ultrasounds to find ovarian cancer as well. But so far to date, we have not demonstrated that doing CA-125 or doing an ultrasound, we catch the cancer early enough that we can save lives. In fact, there is very high false positive rate, means there may not be cancer and test may be abnormal, and a person may end up getting the ovaries out and then not find a cancer. So we are still struggling with this. Unless somebody is a high risk, we do not have an effective screening test for ovarian cancer. Somebody who is a high risk has a strong family history, has genetic predisposition to get the cancer. In those situations, yes, we do CA-125 every 6 months along with an ultrasound. But for somebody who is average risk, unfortunately, at this time, we don't have any screening test for ovarian cancer.
CA-125 being famous because of an email that has gone out to so many people and been forwarded to other people. This poor lady who had ovarian cancer was convinced that you've read the email?
Yeah, no, I haven't.
I've had patients bring it in to me over the years, and it's still going around. They in the email, it says, if my doctor would have done a CA-125, I would have been saved. And we know that just simply is not true, because it would have been positive, like so many of them are. And then what do you do with it? Well, some doctors would pursue it and maybe would have caught it. But we know that if she was anybody else who doesn't have ovarian cancer, she could have taken the same approach. She could have been hurt by this and never have had the ovarian cancer. The rumor is, and I haven't tracked this down and looked at it myself, but that this person actually recanted the email and now is telling people, no, don't get this test. I should actually look that up before saying it.
Well, actually, I did not get the email, and maybe they just deleted my email address from it because I would have looked at the data first. Being an oncologist, I commonly have people bring in articles to me and to get my recommendations based on that. And I'm sitting there basically to give the recommendations based on if there are clinical trials or something. Well, there are many things. All these traditional medications, we did bring them up from the alternative medication. So there are some products or some modalities which are useful there. So which ones are those? It's very difficult. It's the same way with the stock market. Who would have known and picked up the Microsoft at the right time? Even in oncology, different drugs, there are 80 to 200 compounds with one particular manufacturer, and out of them, probably one or two are going to be effective. So CA-125, that email, I can go back to that again and say that, okay, what if everybody get a CA-125 and then it was positive? We need to know is if the test, we should only do the test for which we are going to change what we do. So if everybody's CA-125 is high, are we going to take everybody's ovaries out? Now, and how many of those will have a cancer? And at this time, we have not demonstrated that we have found enough cancer by doing CA-125s to make an effective dent in this ovarian cancer. So I personally would not recommend that to my mom or my sister.
Well, that brings us to the end of this show. Dr. Shahid, we thank you for talking to us about cancer services available in Auburn. We hope that we've been able to get some information out to people that they'll be able to make use of what we have right here at home, right here in Auburn. We're looking forward to our show next week when we'll be able to hopefully be able to have some more listener generated material. Again, we are on Facebook. We have a fan site there where we can write on the wall and have discussions so that all the listeners can participate in them. Thanks again for listening. This is Dr. Mark Vaughn saying stay in good health.